The following is a sermon by Pastor Todd Dykstra, teaching pastor of Maranatha Bible Church of Comstock Park, Michigan. For more information, go to mbcmi.org.
Please open your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 7. If you are new with us today, you need to know that we have been working our way through the book of Ecclesiastes, this wonderful Old Testament book, and we find ourselves this morning beginning chapter 7. As you're finding your way there, let me just begin by saying that things are not always the way they seem to be. Would you agree with that? Things are not always as they seem. A koala bear is not a bear. It is a marsupial. An English horn is not English, and it isn't a horn. It is a French alto oboe, which I didn't know about until I read that this week. A guinea pig is not from Guinea, and it's not a pig. It is a rodent from South America. And grape nuts are neither grapes nor nuts. We're not really sure what they are. Things are not always the way they seem to be. That is true in many areas of life, and that is true in many areas of the spiritual life as well. There are things that when we view them from a secular perspective, they seem bad, yet when viewed from a heavenly perspective, they are viewed entirely different. In this chapter, in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, we come to an issue of perspective. And we come to a portion of Scripture where Solomon begins to help us see things from a different perspective than what we would normally see them from. Let me review if you're new with us today. We have been in this book of Ecclesiastes, and this book really represents the painful autobiography of Solomon, who for much of his life squandered all the marvelous resources that God had blessed him with. He was the wisest, richest, most well-known man in the land of his day. God had blessed him richly with all of these wonderful things. He blessed him with wisdom to rule his people, and Solomon, in his foolishness, turned that wisdom upon himself and began to enjoy all the blessings of God for himself rather than giving God glory for those. He pursued money, possessions, power, stuff, sex, drinking, pleasure. And it all resulted in a dead end. And in the end, Solomon crashed and burned. And he came to the point where he came to say, it's all vanity. Life under the sun, apart from God, is vanity. And Solomon wrote about this. This is his diary, Ecclesiastes is. And in essence, Solomon has run off a cliff, and he sees us approaching that same cliff, and in the book of Ecclesiastes, begins waving his arms, saying, don't go there, been there, done that, there's danger ahead, stop. It's his warning sign to us to not make the same mistakes that he has made. In Ecclesiastes chapter 6, if you were here with us last week, you remember that he really hit rock bottom. In chapter 6, he gets to the bottom of his life, and he is in great despair over this vanity of life apart from God. And now in chapter 7, it begins to become more positive. And he turns the corner and begins to instruct us. Solomon the preacher, Koheleth, begins to advise us and instruct us and proclaim to us and teach us and exhort us on how we are to live in this fallen, broken place that we live. Things are not always the way they seem to be. In chapter 6, he told us that prosperity may not always be as good as it seems. And we looked at this rich man who, hypothetically, had all these riches. He had long years. He had many children. And yet he could not enjoy those because God would not allow him to enjoy them. Prosperity is not always good. Today, in chapter 7, we find that adversity is not always bad. Adversity, hardships, trials in life are not always as bad as it seems. And to demonstrate that for us, Solomon really turns to proverbial language here. Solomon, the author of Proverbs, the one who, according to 1 Kings chapter 4, has written 3,000 Proverbs, more than even contained in the book of Proverbs, now turns to similar proverbial language here in chapter 7 to demonstrate the fact that all earthly events that seem bad may have a heavenly perspective that makes them good. And we need to see those events from God's perspective rather than from our earthly perspective. He uses a series here of better than proverbs. There's a word that occurs a number of times here in Ecclesiastes 7 verses 1 to 14. It's the Hebrew word tov, which is our word good. And yet when it's used in a comparative sense, as it is here in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, it means better than or gooder. That's bad English, but that's the idea. Something is gooder than something else. Something is better than something else. And at least 8 times here in Ecclesiastes 7 verses 1 to 14, Solomon drills this into our hearts that there's something better than something else. Because things are not always the way they seem to be. I invite you to follow along as I read Ecclesiastes 7 verses 1 to 14. Solomon writes, "A good name is better than a good ointment. And the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool, and this too is futility. For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. The end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. Do not say, 'Why is it the former days were better than these?' For it is not for wisdom that you ask about this. Wisdom along with an inheritance is good, an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection, just as money is protection, but the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. Consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten what he has bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy. And in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not discover anything that will be after him." Solomon here uses a series of better than proverbs to show us that adversity is not always bad, and to drive us to trust a sovereign, faithful God who has bent things for his purposes and our good. Some of you are in situations this morning where you are wondering, how can this be good? I'm confident that if we could survey each of your hearts this morning, you would be able to reveal to us an issue in your heart, in your life that's going on, where you are quietly and maybe even secretly saying, "God, how could this possibly be good?" We're going to learn this morning that adversity is not always bad. Things are not always the way they seem to be. And we're going to see these issues from God's perspective. So this morning, I want to give you 7 descriptions of a better way to live. 7 descriptions of a better way to live, directly from Ecclesiastes chapter 7. I got to warn you as we start, though, some of these are going to shock you. Some of these are going to catch you off guard. Some of these may even cause a little consternation in your heart as you see what Solomon says. But I think you'll see as it makes sense as we go through this. Number one, let's look at this. First description of a better way to live is a good reputation is better than great riches. A good reputation is better than great riches. Look at verse 1. Solomon begins by saying, "A good name is better than a good ointment." Your version may say, "A fine perfume." What is this all about? In that day, people had few clothes, and the clothes that they did have got washed very little. And so odors built up over time, and in order to cover these odors, they would rub some oil or some perfume into their clothes and onto their bodies to hide these smells. This was a highly valued commodity in that day, a fine perfume, a good ointment. You needed that. That was valued. This was valued very highly, and so it was a sought-after commodity. It was something that was precious. And so it's a metaphor for riches, for wealth. And Solomon is making a comparison here. He is saying, better than this good ointment, better than this fine perfume, better than all the wealth and riches that you could amass for yourself is to have a good name. There's a wordplay here in Hebrew that you cannot see in English. The words name and ointment or perfume are very similar in the Hebrew. The word name is the word shem, and the word ointment is the word shemen. And so Solomon is making an emphasis here. He is saying, you can have all the riches, all the wealth that you want, and yet better than that is a good name, a good reputation, a good character that backs up your good name. See what Solomon is doing, and you're going to see this as we go throughout this passage, that Solomon takes something that you think is good, and he flips it over and says, it's not as good as this. Think about it. We live in a day where riches are highly prized. We want riches. We want wealth. We want stuff. We live in a culture that values wealth and affluence and prosperity and things and money and resources. We live in a world that assigns value on the basis of money and how much you make and how much you earn. And the idea today is you've really arrived if you reach a certain level of income. Solomon says, huh? No way. You think that? I'll tell you something that's better than that. He flips it on its head and said, there is a better way to live than the accumulation of wealth and things and stuff and money. It's to have a good reputation. It's to be a man, a woman of character. It's to be a man or a woman of good name and repute. See what he's doing? He is taking something from the secular perspective and he's twisting it, turning it up around and saying, no way, not from God's perspective. Much better to be a man or a woman of character than to be a man or a woman of riches. One writer says, Solomon calls us to wear the cologne of good character. Are you wearing the cologne? The perfume of good character. Proverbs 10, verse 7, Solomon, also the writer of this, says, the memory of the righteous will be a blessing, but the name of the wicked will rot. Proverbs 22, verse 1, says, a good name is more desirable than great riches. To be esteemed is better than silver or gold. You see what he's saying? To have a godly reputation, to be a man or a woman of integrity and a character that matches that is far better than any kind of wealth that you'll ever collect for yourself. Your name is a demonstration of your reputation. You understand that? Your name reflects your character. Let me give you some names. I want you to tell me what you think comes to your mind, or just think about what comes to your mind when you think of these names. What do you think about Abraham Lincoln? It's honesty, right? He's an honest man. What about Eric Liddell, the Chariots of Fire guy? Remember him? Man of integrity. Man of character. What about Daniel? Remember him? Man of convictions. How about some of these names? Saddam Hussein. Hitler. Judas. Your name is synonymous with your character. And so that's what Solomon is saying. He's saying your name is better than any kind of ointment or riches or wealth that you could amass for yourself. In fact, it's much easier to maintain a good name than it is to try and recover your name after you've fallen, right? It's better to preserve your name and have a good name in the first place than to attempt to reacquire it once it's been lost. How's your name? How's your character? How's your reputation? How's your integrity? You know, we tell our kids every day on the way out of school, on the way out the door to school, remember who you are. I think they're tired of hearing of it. I think they're sick of hearing of it. But we're going to tell them every day you walk out the door, remember who you are. Who are you? You're a Dykstra. You carry our name. And you bring reproach upon our name when you act in an appropriate way, but you bring blessing to our family when you act in an appropriate way. Remember who you are. And more importantly, you're Christ's. Honor Christ. What kind of name are you making for yourself? What kind of name do you have? What kind of reputation do you have? If I were to go and survey your friends, your family, your neighbors, your coworkers, their friends at school, the people who know you best, what would they say about your name, your reputation, your character, your integrity? Does your name mean something? We live in a day where we plan and we advance forward in our careers and our education, and we think about our income and our jobs and our promotions. We put a lot of effort into those things, and yet do we put as much effort into our names, our reputations, our character? A good name is better than great riches. Number two. There's a second description of how to live better, and it's this: your death day is better than your birthday. This is really going to mess with you. Your death day is better than your birthday. Look at verse 1. He says, the second part of verse 1, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Really? Well, what is Solomon talking about here? I mean, most of us think of the day of our birth as one of joy and excitement and congratulations. And you think about it, this is what happens when someone's born. What happens? You go down to the hospital, you congratulate mom and dad, you bring flowers, you bring candy, there's a celebration, there's photos, there's video. They take the baby's feet and they put ink on the bottom and they stamp a piece of paper. It's a celebration, right? It's great joy. This is a time of great anticipation, and it's come, and dad takes time off work, and this is a great occasion. And then every year thereafter, on that same day, you have a birthday, and you celebrate. Tomorrow's Emily's birthday. We're having a party. There's going to be cake and ice cream, I think, and all kinds of celebration and presents, and there's a birthday, and we're going to celebrate that, and then my birthday is Thursday, in case you wanted to send me a card or something. But that's Thursday, and so we're celebrating this Thursday, my birthday, and we celebrate these things. You don't do that on your death day. I've sat at the bedside of many dying people, surrounded by their family and their loved ones, and it's no party. But Solomon reverses it. He says, that's what you think. From a secular perspective, you think your birthday is a day of celebration? No way. It's not what you think. You flip it around. The day of your death is better than the day of your birth. How in the world is this true? You remember that all throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon has forced us to come face to face with our own mortality. He's caused us to look in the mirror of death and see our own face there and come to the point where we realize that's us. Chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Better to have died and been freed from injustices of this life than to still be living and experience them. Ecclesiastes chapter 6. Better to have died at birth than to live and not be satisfied with what God has given you. Over and over and over again. And if you're sick of hearing about death, I got to warn you, it's going to get worse with the rest of the book. Solomon wants us to see ourselves lying in a casket. And he wants us to realize that there's coming a day when a doctor will announce our time of death and pull the sheet over our dead body. And a funeral director will take our bodies to their funeral home and prepare it for visitation. And people will come there and they will parade across your casket and they will see you lying there. And there will be a memorial service where they will talk about you and they will honor your name and your reputation. And then someday your body's going to be placed in the ground. You're going to die. No amount of working out, eating right, nutrition, vitamins, no amount of green smoothies is going to change that. My wife's been on a green smoothie kick lately. It's not going to change anything. May make you healthy for a while, but you can't change the fact that God has called a day when we will enter His presence, when we will stand before Him. And Solomon is forcing us to look at things from a heavenly perspective rather than an earthly perspective. There's coming a day when you will have to die. And he says that day is better than the day of your death. You say, how's that? How can that be? It's only true for believers. It's only true for us who know Christ and love Christ. Death is good for the believer. You understand that? And so around a bedside of a believer, there is a sense of joy and there is a sense of rejoicing. Death is good for the believer because it ends life in this broken world. We get to depart. We get to flee from this sinful, wicked, sorrowful, sin-filled place. And we get to be liberated from a body that has suffered the effects of living in a sin-cursed world. We get to have the power of sin, the penalty of sin broken. Our sanctification is completed. Our glorification is completed. We're with Christ. We see His face. We're in His presence for all of eternity. That's way better than our birth, isn't it? I mean, think about it. Let's put this in perspective. When you come into this world, when you're born, you enter a sin-cursed place. You come into a world where there's all kinds of oppression and injustice and sadness and sorrow and pain and oppression. If you think about it, there's not really a lot to rejoice about when you enter life. But if you know Christ, if you're rightly related to God, oh, there's a lot to look forward to. There's great things to anticipate as we see Christ face to face and be in His presence. In that sense, our death day is better than our birthday, isn't it? This is not true for the unbeliever. Those who don't know Christ, those who have not surrendered to the Lord Jesus Christ, that day is not good. This is as good as it gets for them. This is as worse as it gets for us who know Christ. So it is the funeral, not the raucous birthday party, that poses the ultimate questions of life. Are you ready to die? Are you ready to die well? I'm a little fearful about the dying process, but I'm not too scared about death, right? Only when you're prepared to die are you able to live. Number three, mourning is better than rejoicing. This follows closely on the heels of number two. Mourning is better than rejoicing. Look at verse two. Solomon says, it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. He says it's better to go to a funeral than a wedding. It's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting. You see what Solomon's doing? He is taking something that our culture values and that we hold dearly, happiness and entertainment and pleasure and parties and festivities. He's taking that and he turns it on its head and says, no, you think that's something? No, it's not. You should go to a house of mourning. This is so contrary to how we live. Few of us like to mourn. Few of us like sorrow. Few of us like sadness. We like parties. We like joy. We like happiness. We like to go to places where there's a celebration that's happening. And when adversity comes, most of us look for ways to escape it. And Solomon turns that notion on its head. He says it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. Adversity is not always bad. The house of mourning here is probably literally a house that someone would go to when someone died. And that day when someone died, they would take the body to the house where they lived, and they would have people come and visit them in that house, the place of their residence. And it was customary in that day for people to pay their last respects in the house of the person who died. The house of feasting is a place of a party, a celebration. And Solomon says, if you have your choice, you should choose to go to a house of mourning instead of a house of feasting. He says it's good to have a direct encounter with death. This is so opposite to how we live, isn't it? We don't even like to talk about death. We even use different terms for death. The person who's passed on. The person who has departed, the person who has passed away, this person has gone to a better place, or they're not with us anymore. We don't even like the term death because it's too personal. It gets too much to who we are. And so who in their right mind would go to a funeral rather than a party? But Solomon says, if you really want to live, if you want to live better, you should mourn rather than rejoice. Why? Look at verse 2. He says at the end of verse 2, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Oh, this is so good. The reason you should mourn, the reason you should enjoy, or not enjoy, appreciate mourning more than rejoicing, is because it is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Here's what he's saying. Death will happen to every person. No one's immune, no one's exempt. It is the great equalizer. And he says, when we mourn the death of another person, we take it to heart. This is his way of saying that it forces us to think about our own death. It forces us to think about our own mortality. It brings us face to face with the fact that we too will die. And when things are going smoothly and there's little adversity, we don't think about those things. We don't think about the things of eternity. We don't think about the things of the Lord. We're not pondering the things that really matter in life when life is going smoothly. But when death is imminent, when death comes to someone else, when we stand before the casket of another person, when we attend a funeral, suddenly our attention is riveted upon eternal matters. You get that? It grabs us and shakes us and grips us and grabs us by the lapels and says, this will be you. Are you ready? You see, when you're face to face with death, you don't put all your hopes in life. You don't live for this world. You don't live for what matters most here, because death makes us think about eternity. So Solomon's point is, if you really want to get in touch with the reality, if you really want to live, if you really want to have your heart affected by the things that matter most and the things of eternity, you should go to the house of mourning, not the house of feasting. You know, as a pastor, I would much rather do a funeral than a wedding. Now, let me clarify that. I love weddings. I got the best seat in the house. I can see the bride coming down the aisle. I can see the future groom weeping, you know, tears just pouring down his face. You get to see him go stand next to each other. You get to watch him right there in front of you. And you get to watch him kiss, you know, right there, and then face everybody. It's the best seat in the house. I love weddings. I'll tell you, for the sake of eternity, I would much rather do a funeral. Here's why. People listen at funerals. This was driven home to me just a couple of weeks ago. We were in Montana. Julie and I were at that wedding. I got to do the service, the wedding. And a person came up to me afterwards, very complimentary. And they said, you know, Todd, great wedding. I really appreciate the service, the sermon. Great job. I actually listened. This is what this person said. And then they said this: I normally tune out the message at a wedding. What are they saying? They're saying, when I'm at a wedding, it's happy. Everyone's happy. There's nothing to be worried about. And so we just kind of all celebrate, and you just kind of listen and go on your way, and it's great. But when you're at a funeral, you listen. I've done some funerals where you can hear a pin drop, because people are so riveted on the things of eternity. You can watch. You can see people looking in your eye as you bring the Word of God and you talk about eternity and the things that matter most in life. They are fixed on your eyes as they see and they come face to face with their own mortality. I'd much rather do a funeral than a wedding. A funeral is a preview of our own. Right? Every funeral is a preview of our own funeral. I think about that. I wonder, what will my funeral be like? Will anyone come? What will they say? Who will be here? When you think about your own funeral, it has a way of clarifying your life. So Solomon says, you better go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting. There's much more things you can learn there. It makes you much more attentive to the matters of eternity. Look at verse 3, he says the same thing in a different way. He says, sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. He's saying the same thing here. He says it's better to mourn and be sorrowful than to rejoice and be happy and laugh. Now, is Solomon against laughing? No. It's good to laugh. There's things in life to laugh about. You should laugh about those things. But he says it's better to be sorrowful and face the facts of reality and come face to face with eternity than it is just to keep laughing your life away and never pondering the things that really matter. He says, you want to be wise? Look at verse 3. When the face is sad, a heart may be happy. Verse 4, the mind of the wise is in the house of mourning. If you want to be wise, go mourn. Be sorrowful. Face reality. And you'll be a wise person. If you don't, you're going to be foolish. The end of verse 4 says, while the mind of fools is in the house of mourning. You want to be a fool the rest of your life? Just entertain yourself. Never consider the matters of eternity. Just laugh, turn on the TV, numb your mind with reruns of Seinfeld, keep the headphones on, watch the movies, just keep numbing your mind and never, ever, ever allow your heart to penetrate the things of eternity. And Solomon says, you'll be a fool. Because you never ponder the spiritual realities very deeply at all. He says it's better to be confronted with death, sorrow, sadness, because it forces you to think about how you live and how you're going to die. Jesus said this as well. Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 4, in the Beatitudes, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Luke chapter 6, verse 21, blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Listen, it's better to mourn now and laugh someday than laugh now and mourn someday. Friends, do you see that there is spiritual profit in sorrow? Do you see that it's good? Adversity is good. You see what he's doing? He is flipping our secular perspective on the things of life and death on its head and forcing us to see these issues from a heavenly perspective. And he's saying there is spiritual profit in sorrow, in sadness, and in death. You remember this quote by C.S. Lewis? He says, God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks to us in our conscience, but he shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. End quote. Pain, sorrow, sadness, suffering, death is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world and to get them to think about the things of eternity. Does it make you think? Listen. Don't fill your life and all the dead spaces and all the white spaces in your life with noise and pleasure and entertainment. If you do, you will never allow your heart to consider the things that matter most. I don't like being the guy that says this is what's wrong with our generation today, but this is what's wrong with our generation today. We got people just entertaining themselves and benumbing themselves with things of this life that never cause them to penetrate the deep things of God. Think about eternal realities. Mourn, sorrow. Let your heart be engaged about what really matters. Number four, rebuke is better than praise. Rebuke is better than praise. Verse 5. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool, and this too is futility. He says it's better to be rebuked and confronted than it is to be praised and flattered. Oh, we love flattery though, don't we? We love when people come up to us and tell us how great we are, how good we are. They compliment us, and outwardly we're saying, oh no, 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 no. And inwardly we're saying, yeah, bring it on, come on, tell me more. We like to be flattered. We love people to praise us and applaud us and commend us and verbally stroke us. Solomon says it's just the song of a fool. It's just the song of a fool. It's here and then it's gone. Those flattering words are there for a moment and they're gone. Look at verse 6. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. You see what he's saying here? He's saying in that day, when you needed to heat something very quickly, or you just needed a quick fire, you would actually pull all these thorn bushes together and throw them on a fire, and it would flame up really hot very quick, and then it would die down and be gone. Crackle, it would spark, it would flame up quickly, and then it was done. You ever torch a dry Christmas tree? It's kind of fun, isn't it? All you pyromaniacs, just nod it and acknowledge this. You torch it, it's quick fire, and then it goes away. It's done. That's the idea. Such is the empty praise of people. Such is flattery. By the way, flattery is what people will say to your face that they won't say behind your back. Gossip is the opposite. Gossip is what they'll say behind your back without to your face. Flattery is what they'll say to your face, not behind your back. Solomon says, that stuff just flames up quick and it's gone. It's here and then gone. It's the empty praise of people. It's here momentarily and it's gone quickly. That's why he says at the end of verse 6, it's just futility. Just vanity. Here for a moment, steam off a cup of coffee. Here and then gone. What's better? Verse 5. Verse 5 says, it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to listen to a fool, the praise of a fool. It's better to listen to rebuke. It's better to have people in your life confront you. It's better to have people in your life who love you so much that they will come to you when they see you in sin and they will confront you in love and they will call out your sin and they will call for your repentance. This is constructive criticism. He says, oh, that's far better. Far better than this empty praise of flattery that comes and then goes. You put people in your life who will correct you and criticize you lovingly and call out your sin. Then you'll live wisely. I wish we had more time. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 1. So much is written in Proverbs about this. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid. We don't let our kids say that word, but it's in the Bible, and so it works here. If you hate correction, you're stupid. You're a fool. Proverbs 13, verse 1, a wise son heeds his father's instruction, but a mocker does not listen to rebuke. Want to live wisely? You put people in your life who will call you out in love. Proverbs 27, verse 6 says, wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. I have been blessed to have people in my life who have done this. My wife has done this. My kids have done this. Some of you here today have done this. And I thank you. I am more like Christ today because of your loving correction and your loving rebuke of me. And there's been times I've needed it. And God has lovingly and kindly placed people in my life here at this church to call me out. And I'm more like Christ because of it. Painful? Yeah. Hard to hear? Absolutely. But it's better than the praise of fools. Do you have people in your life like that? Do you have people in your life who love you enough? Have you opened yourself up? Have you actually allowed people into your life? Have you invited people in your life to criticize you and correct you and rebuke you when necessary? Have you surrounded yourself who will tell you the things that you need to hear even when you don't want to hear them? It's how you live wisely. It's how you live better. Invite criticism. Invite rebuke. When was the last time you went to someone and said, you know what? I need you in my life to ask me the hard questions. Number 5. The end is better than the beginning. A good name is better than great riches. Your death day is better than your birthday. Mourning is better than rejoicing. Rebuke is better than praise. Number 5. The end is better than the beginning. Look at verse 8. He says, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. The outcome of something is better than its beginning. And what he's getting at here is oftentimes there are things that don't start out well and you think they're not going to end well. But Solomon says you've got to look at this from a heavenly perspective, not an earthly one. And oftentimes there are things that do not seem at all promising in the beginning that turn out well. When God is on the throne and God is sovereign, this is what happens. When you're trusting God, when you're looking to God, the sovereign creator of the universe, who is above this earth, and you trust Him, the end of all things is better than the beginning. This is Romans 8:28 of the Old Testament. For we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him and who have been called according to His purpose. The end of all things for believers is always better than the beginning, isn't it? Whether it's in this life or the next life, Even if we can't see the good in the trial that we're in this life, even if it's a trial that lasts your whole life, the end is still better than the beginning for believers. This is Solomon's hope here. And this isn't the way things seem, though, right? You get in a trial in your life, you get in some adversity in your life, and you get into some circumstances that are painful and sorrowful, and you start scratching your head, and you start saying, God, where are you? What's going on here? And he says, you be convinced of this. Know that when God is on the throne, and your eyes are on him, the end is better than the beginning. What adversity are you going through right now? What trials? Hardships. I'll tell you, the trials that we've been through in having kids and adoption and trials in ministry have taught us one thing. They have taught us that when we face another trial in the future, that the end of that trial will be better than its beginning. That God can be trusted. That he is dependable. That he is reliable. That he is faithful. We don't always going to see how it's going to end, but he's faithful. He's good. He's trustworthy. Are you convinced of that? Number 6, patience is better than anger. This follows right on it. Same thing. Patience is better than anger. Verse 8, he says, patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. He says, when adversity strikes your life, it is better to patiently endure it and patiently wait for God to work through it than it is to get angry and be impatient about it. What do you do when things don't go your way? We get angry. We get frustrated. We get impatient. We start saying, God, this isn't how things are supposed to go. This is not the plan. Where are you? Are you still on your throne? Can this be good? God, what's happening here? We get angry with God. We get angry with people. We get angry because something is not happening as quickly as it should. And Solomon says, to get angry is the height of foolishness. It's the height of foolishness. It's better to be patient. Better to be patient than be angry. Psalm 27, verses 13 and 14. I'm still confident of this. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. He's saying, be patient. Trust God in the midst of your adversity because he's working and he's good and he's sovereign and he's got a plan here. Are you trusting God or are you angry? Can I be a little autobiographical with you? I realized when I got married, I was a selfish person. I didn't realize that until marriage, but I'll tell you this, I didn't realize how impatient I was until I had kids. Can you relate to that, parents? I never knew how impatient I was until there were 5 rugrats running around our house, and it's loud, and it's chaotic, and it's noisy. And you know what? God knew what he was doing. He knew I needed to grow in patience. And he knew I needed to learn patience in the midst of all of that. And he's been faithful. It's better to be patient than to get angry. Number 7. Wisdom about the present is better than nostalgia about the past. Wisdom about the present is better than nostalgia about the past. Look at verse 10. Do not say, why is it the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. This is the good old days theology. This is you sitting in your rocking chair remembering back and saying, oh, I remember those days. Oh, my marriage was so great then. Oh, my kids. Oh, where we lived, it was so wonderful. Now, today, oh, horrible. That's what he's saying. He says, do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? He says, that's foolish. Don't live your life looking in the past. Don't look at the past things that have happened to you as if that was really when life was happening and God was glorified in your life. No, he says, don't you live in the past. Can't face the difficulties of the past, or the present rather, by longing for the past. You know, there's danger in nostalgia. You understand that? There's danger in nostalgia. I grew up skiing at Canonsburg. I was a young kid. My dad took me there every Monday night. Pretty cool place, I thought. Moved out west for 15 years and then came back 7 years ago. And I remember driving by Canonsburg. I remember as a kid thinking, man, this place is huge. This is awesome. Whoa, Canonsburg. I remember the first time I drove back after drove by after being back. I looked at that and I thought, you gotta be kidding me. I was excited about that place. It's an anthill. So the danger of nostalgia. It's foolish. Verse 11, wisdom along with an inheritance is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection, just as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. Only wisdom will last. How do you live wisely? You live in the present, not the past. You live today to the glory of God, not yesterday. Don't look in your past and say, man, if I could be in those circumstances again, then I could really live for God and really live for Christ. No, you live today for Christ. The present, and wisely trusting God for the present is better than the nostalgia of the past. Well, those are seven better than statements. How you can live better than a secular perspective. You see, things are not always the way they appear, are they? Things are not always the way they appear. Well, what's the conclusion of this? I mean, where does this leave us? What is the overarching theme? You kind of look at these things and say, well, they're not very related. What's the overarching theme here? You have this and this and this. They're not really connected to each other. What's the overarching theme? Look at verse 13. Here it is. Let's close with this. Consider the work of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent in the day of prosperity? Be happy. Enjoy your life. Thank God for all the things he blesses you with. Give him glory for your food and your house and your clothes and your cars and everything. Enjoy that. Be happy with your prosperity. But, verse 14, in the days of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. You understand what he's saying here? You trust God in the days of your adversity as much as in the days of your prosperity. We trust a holy, sovereign, faithful God because God brings the good times and God brings the bad times for his purposes. Are you trusting in that? There is a better way to live. And the better way to live is to live life through the lens of the sovereign hand of God through which all things come to us for our good and for his glory. Father, thank you for Solomon. Thank you for his willingness to teach us these things, as hard as they may be, as contrary as they may be to the things that we know and understand. Thank you for his honesty. Lord, let us learn, let us put into practice these things so that we can live better for the glory of God and the glory of Christ. In his name we pray.
You've been listening to a sermon by Pastor Todd Dykstra, teaching pastor of Maranatha Bible Church in Comstock Park, Michigan, where we exist to display God's glory, declare God's truth, delight in God's Son, and disciple God's people. No part of this digital file may be reproduced or distributed without prior written consent. For permission, go to mbcmi.org.